Another Point of View, a program which seeks to provide our listeners with thoughtful, insightful news and commentary from a range of political perspectives on current issues in the United States. I'm Michael Houck, and unfortunately, my reading partner Bob Golden is away. So, sorry to say, dear listeners, you will have to put up with just me for today's program. As usual, I will be reading selected articles from the online news service Tangle. Tangle is an independent, nonpartisan, and subscriber-supported media organization that covers the major political stories in the United States. Tangle seeks to produce truly non-biased reporting on current events by providing responsible views from across the political spectrum in every single article, clearly labeling what is opinion and what isn't. It's important to note that the views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the article authors and their publishers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the audio journal, its staff, or the volunteer readers. With that introduction, let's dive into a couple of articles from the current news cycle. Our first article for today's program comes from the Tangle newsletter of July the 2nd. The Supreme Court's rulings on executive power. On Monday, June the 29th, the Supreme Court issued two decisions on the president's power to remove leaders of federal agencies. In the first case, Trump v. Slaughter, the court voted 6-3 to strike down a federal law that limited the president's power to fire Federal Trade Commission members. In the second, Trump v. Cook, the court voted 5-4 that Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook can remain in her role while her legal challenge to President Trump's attempts to fire her plays out. Background on the Slaughter case. In March 2025, President Trump fired FTC Commissioner Rebecca Slaughter, stating her continued presence would be, quote, inconsistent with my administration's priorities, close quote. Slaughter, one of two Democratic commissioners on the bipartisan Consumer Protection Board at the time, was nominated by Trump in 2018 and renominated by President Joe Biden in 2023. Slaughter challenged her firing, citing a law that states commissioners can only be removed for, quote, inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office, close quote. A district court judge ruled in her favor and ordered her reinstated. A panel of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals declined to block the reinstatement. In September, the Supreme Court allowed Trump to remove Slaughter while considering the case. The majority's decision struck down the statute that Slaughter cited, overruling the court's previous finding in Humphrey's Executor versus the United States from 1935 that upheld the law. Although it is up to the Senate to decide whether to confirm those with whom the president would prefer to work, neither Congress nor the courts may saddle him with those with whom he cannot work, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote. The court's three Democratic-appointed justices dissented. Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote that the case, quote, should have begun and ended with, close quote, Humphrey's Executor, adding, today, the majority places accountability to the president above all else. The background on the Cook case. In August of 2025, Trump ordered the removal of Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook, who was originally appointed by Biden in 2022, to serve on the Federal Reserve's seven-person board of governors. Trump stated he was firing Cook, quote, for cause due to alleged mortgage fraud. Cook denied wrongdoing and challenged her firing in court. In September, U.S. District Judge Jai Cobb found that while the Federal Reserve Act contains the for cause provision, it only covers a governor's behavior in office. Judge Cobb issued an order allowing Cook to remain in office while litigation continued, and a panel of the D.C. Circuit upheld the order. The Trump administration then asked the Supreme Court to intervene, and the justices heard oral arguments in January. The majority decision, penned by Chief Justice Roberts and joined by Justices Elena Kagan, Brett Kavanaugh, Sonia Sotomayor, and Ketanji Brown Jackson, read, quote, "Congress limited the president's power to remove governors for good reason, to preserve the independence of the Federal Reserve, and to continue the long tradition of monetary policy exercised independent of executive influence," close quote. Justices Clarence Thomas and Amy Coney Barrett dissented alone, and Justice Samuel Alito's dissent was joined by Justice Neil Gorsuch. Barrett argued that the majority was erroneously carving out a special exception for the Federal Reserve. Quote, "The court's holding is in serious tension with Trump v. Slaughter, which we also decide today," close quote. In this newsletter, we'll get into what the political left and right are saying about these two agency rulings. Then, Associate Editor Audrey Moorhead gives her take on the court's decisions. First up, what the political left is saying. The highlights. The left opposes the Slaughter decision, and many say its rationale is inconsistent with its decision in Cook. Some suggest the court actually did little to protect Fed officials. Others argue the majority erred in overturning Humphrey's executor. In the American Prospect, David Dayan called Slaughter and Cook, quote, "impossible to reconcile." Dayan wrote, "Much of what you need to know about who rules America can be found in two Supreme Court opinions released today. They reinforce how the law is interpreted by this court is malleable depending on whom it's applied to. If you work in the executive branch, you can now be fired by the president for whatever reason or no reason at all, even if the law creating the agency said you needed a reason. This new standard overturns 91 years of precedent and is now the law in every case, except if the agency you work for is the Federal Reserve. None of these independent agencies will ever operate the same way again. If presidents can fire any member of the executive branch at will, why would anyone from the opposite party willing to criticize executive branch decisions be allowed to stay in the government? You can make at least a colorable argument that a president should be allowed to have control over their subordinates. But when you add in the carve-out for the Federal Reserve, it quickly becomes totally ridiculous. There is no way to hold the two rulings together at once. In MS Now, Ray Brescia suggested the court essentially authorized future harassment of Federal Reserve officials. Brescia wrote, "The court has handed the administration yet another tool for applying pressure on the Fed's members, the punishment of procedure. The court did not look at the language of the two statutes at issue in Cook and Slaughter. Instead, it turned to the history of federal banking entities, like the existence of the first and second banks of the United States in the early days of the Republic, to claim that monetary policy has been treated differently from other functions of the government over the years." While the court's majority opinion in Cook's case did technically reject the Trump administration's efforts to terminate her from her position, it laid out a clear path for the administration to do so in the future. It must provide her notice of the ground or grounds upon which she is being terminated, and she must be given an opportunity to challenge those allegations. Once a final decision is made by the executive branch, she can go to court to challenge that determination. But there is nothing stopping the administration from commencing such a process on any basis it wants, or no basis at all. In The Atlantic, George Thomas wrote, "An originalist court overturns an originalist decision." Thomas wrote, "Humphrey's executor offered a better understanding of the separation of powers, one consistent with constitutional history, originalist understandings, and earlier court precedent than what Roberts offers in Slaughter. In Humphrey's, the court saw a distinction between an administrative function, something the executive branch stewards, and true executive power in the constitutional sense. By contrast, Roberts' opinion in Slaughter's collapses with this distinction. For Roberts, to faithfully execute the law, the president must have the power to remove officers of independent commissions. The Roberts Court is solidifying a formalistic version of the separation of powers that narrows congressional power while expanding presidential power. Its logic points to the idea that all administration functions are an inherent part of the executive power and must be brought under the control of the president. Yet even Roberts cannot swallow the direction of his reasoning. That is why he exempted the Federal Reserve Board from the implications of his decision. Roberts notes that monetary policy at the core of the national bank's mission is not subject, quote, to plenary presidential control, close quote. True, but this is just as true of the regulation of commerce or trade. So why doesn't this logic apply to the Federal Trade Commission? And now, we turn to what the political right is saying. The highlights. The right supports the decisions, particularly the overturning of Humphrey's executor. Some say Slaughter will allow presidents to more efficiently pursue their agenda. Others suggest the tension between Slaughter and Cook is difficult to reconcile. In City Journal, Isla Shapiro said, "Humphrey's executor has been slaughtered." Shapiro wrote, "The Supreme Court today restored an old-fashioned constitutional idea. If a principal federal officer exercises executive power, the president must be able to remove him." Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that Humphrey's framework, in short, has not withstood the test of time. Then came the sentence that will launch 1,000 administrative law articles. "If anything more is left of Humphrey's, we overrule it." The New Deal compromise that invented quasi-legislative agencies has finally met Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution. This ruling isn't a gift to Donald Trump or his successors. It's a restoration of constitutional accountability. Congress can create executive branch agencies and specify what they may do, but it cannot create a fourth branch of government and then pretend its officers are independent of the only person the Constitution makes responsible for executing federal law. Taken together, Slaughter and Cook draw the right constitutional map. The FTC and similar agencies sit within the executive branch and must answer to the president. The Federal Reserve remains a narrow historical exception. The Washington Post editorial board wrote about Lisa Cook's close Supreme Court call. The board wrote, "Roberts explained that the Fed would effectively come under the president's thumb if the firing stood, as any perceived or alleged missteps, past or present, could provide a ready pretext for a governor's removal. If the Federal Reserve Act of 1913's for-cause provision is going to have teeth, Fed governors need to be insulated from arbitrary firing." The justices sidestepped what threshold the president needs to meet. That means Trump could still prevail in his effort to remove Cook, but the administration will need to at least devise a process that looks more legitimate than Federal Housing Finance Director Bill Pulte's search and destroy mission against Democrats. There's definitely a tension between Cook and Slaughter. The Fed, after all, acts more like a regulator than the country's early central banks, such as by imposing fines on financial institutions. But the best way to lessen the tension isn't to extinguish the Fed's independence. The better solution is for Congress to reform the Fed so it focuses on its core monetary mission. Some of its regulatory functions could be eliminated or transferred to the Treasury Department. In the Washington Examiner, Jay Powers praised the courts for ending the myth of independent agencies. Powers wrote, "The Humphrey Executor was always a historical anomaly. It emerged from FDR's war with the Supreme Court over New Deal agencies. The theory was that some agencies were quasi-legislative, quasi-judicial in nature, and therefore somehow outside normal executive authority. The logic has always strained. The FTC administers roughly 80 statutes covering nearly every facet of the economy. It makes rules. It enforces law. It adjudicates disputes. That is executive work. Congress can still require bipartisan composition. It can still structure agencies with staggered terms and Senate confirmation. What it cannot do is exempt those officers from removal when the president concludes they're working against his administration's policies. That's the difference between a president who governs and a president who presides over a bureaucracy he can't direct. The electorate voted for a candidate with specific views on how these agencies should operate. Monday's ruling means those views can actually be implemented." And finally, we turn to the analysis and opinion of Tangle Associate Editor Audrey Moorhead. The highlights: these cases underscore the tension between originalism in theory and practice. I tentatively side with the majority in Slaughter, but the court isn't consistent with its logic in Cook. I think the practical effects of these decisions will be relatively limited, though long-term concerns remain. Slaughter and Cook are possibly the most fascinating set of decisions I've seen in my relatively brief time as a court watcher. It's rare for the same justice to write two majority opinions in two very similar cases and come to two different conclusions joined by two different majorities. But that's exactly what Chief Justice Roberts did here. Slaughter is the further-reaching case, granting the president the power to fire employees from any federal agency, even those established by Congress as independent, except as Cook holds the Federal Reserve. Reading the opinions in Slaughter, I found Roberts' originalist understanding of the Constitution and subsequent reasoning for overturning the Humphreys executor precedent more convincing than Justice Sotomayor's dissent arguing for maintaining that precedent. But like many court watchers, I ultimately struggle to reconcile Slaughter with Cook, and I find myself wondering whether the correct legal reasoning may lead to a bad outcome. Many of the Supreme Court's Republican-appointed justices are self-described originalists, meaning they prioritize the original intent of the Constitution and federal law where it doesn't conflict with the Constitution. The legal theory has outsized sway on this court, but it comes with trade-offs, and one of the court's originalists once offered a fascinating and complicated analysis of this approach. In 2017, when she was still a professor at Notre Dame Law School, Justice Amy Coney Barrett published an essay called "Originalism and Stare Decisis," grappling with the question of how originalist justices ought to handle long-standing precedent. She acknowledged that originalism can conflict with the precedent that forms the basis for our constitutional order. She points to the New Deal era, expressions and changes in federal power, like those in the now-defunct decision, Humphrey's Executor, as an example of precedent that is in tension with an originalist understanding of the Constitution, but is so entrenched in modern governmental function that rolling back those changes could prove deeply destabilizing. Interestingly, Barrett concedes that originalist judges can sometimes choose not to follow their principles to their absolute ends when they know doing so would risk overturning load-bearing precedent. Instead, she argues that the important thing is that their jurisprudence draws consistent lines in applying originalist readings or deferring to precedent. This article has much to bear on Slaughter, which overturned the 90-year-old precedent set by Humphrey's executor by declaring that the president can fire federal officials, even those purported to belong to independent agencies where Congress initially attached for-cause firing provisions. Barrett's article put into words my misgivings about Slaughter, a case where sheer adherence to principle, which I usually admire, could potentially have cascading negative effects. I'd say Roberts and Kavanaugh agree with me, given that they ruled to preserve precedent in Cook, but here I fear that their inconsistency only creates confusion. I find the majority's reasoning, laid out by Chief Justice John Roberts, fairly airtight as a constitutional matter. Roberts is an attentive student of history, and his retelling of the first 150 years of the debate over executive power before Humphrey's executor was thorough and convincing. Then he asserts that the Supreme Court had long ago retreated from applying Humphrey's executor to other agencies and even undermined its premises at every turn. In fact, Roberts argues, Humphreys is so difficult to apply that various lower courts have differed on its requirements, meaning that it doesn't even create the stability that long-standing precedent often affords. I'm aligned with all of these points, but Roberts' argument begins to slip when he discusses Congress's reliance upon Humphreys. The Chief Justice claims that Congress has relied upon this precedent to expand its own power, and that that expression of power is, quote, hardly one of the legitimate reliances interests that our precedents contemplate, close quote. Fair enough. But he fails to fully grapple with Justice Sonia Sotomayor's counter that ordinary Americans and regulated firms alike have organized their affairs understanding that some government decisions will depend not on political favoritism or partisan advantage, or at least not only on those considerations, but on expertise, adherence to law, judgment, and the public good. Sotomayor is right that much of the country trusts these agencies more because they believe them to be nonpartisan and unaffected by the shifting tides of politics. Even if you think it shouldn't be so, or if you think that the nonpartisan nature of these agencies is a sham, you're still fighting against years of an established public understanding. Roberts maintains that the American people's interest in their constitutional guarantees is more important than their trust in nonpartisan agencies. But his high-minded appeal rings hollow. Whatever Roberts believes about the Constitution, functionally overturning the precedent of independent federal agencies seriously undermines the average American's understanding of the way the government works or ought to work. The fundamental tension of the court's decision in Slaughter is illustrated by its opinion in Cook, where Roberts, again writing for the majority, hardly seems to grapple at all with why the Fed might be exempt from the rules he lays out in Slaughter. Indeed, that's the very argument Justice Barrett makes in her Cook dissent, that the court is inconsistent in its application of principle. Barrett was convinced by Roberts' reasoning that the time had come to overturn Humphrey's erroneous precedent. But if that's the case, why stop one agency short? Justice Kavanaugh's Cook concurrence attempts to establish that the Fed should be treated completely separately under historical precedent, but it's not a consistently originalist argument. I'd say instead that Roberts and Kavanaugh are aware that pure originalism toward the Fed would invite the governmental chaos that Barrett once acknowledged as a major risk. Roberts and Kavanaugh come off as if they've caught between two worlds. The three Democratic-appointed justices wanted to uphold Humphreys because of the precedent on their side. Justice Barrett decided that the application of principle was worth the risk of upending order, as did, presumably, Justices Gorsuch, Alito, and Thomas. But Roberts and Kavanaugh want to have their cake and eat it too. They want to see a return to the pre-Humphreys principle, but they're worried about the negative consequences of an overwhelming change. In the end, I think it fosters confused legal reasoning that will hurt rather than help the court in future cases. With that said, I'm optimistic that the partisan concerns about the effect of overturning Humphrey's executor are relatively overblown. Yes, this grants Trump more power over the federal government, but it also grants future presidents the same power. And I think, on the whole, that that could be a moderating force. After all, presidents ousting prior appointees isn't anything new. President Biden spent the first part of 2021 cleaning house of various Trump appointees, in some cases breaking presidential precedent around agency appointees to do so. Even if I'm less afraid of the former long-term impacts of partisan staffing of these agencies, I'm still broadly worried about what this decision will do in the immediate future. The Roberts Court may have gotten the constitutional question right in Slaughter, but I'm left wondering if there might have been some other way to restore the constitutional order without such a seismic shift in established precedent. If there's anything I've learned from Trump, too, it's that a move fast, break things approach can have disastrous and unintended consequences. Please stay tuned. I'll be back with a second article after a brief pause.
Stay tuned. There's more ahead.
You are listening to Another Point of View, a production of the Audio Journal.
The second article for today's program comes from the Tangle newsletter of July the 7th, the Supreme Court's campaign finance ruling. Last Tuesday, June the 30th, the Supreme Court held that a federal law limiting the amount of money political parties could spend in coordination with campaigns violated the First Amendment. The court's vote was 6-3 along ideological lines. The background. In 1971, Congress passed the Federal Election Campaign Act, or FECA, to set limits on spending in federal elections. A 1974 amendment to FECA introduced limits on coordinated expenditures, or political party committees' spending, in direct collaboration with campaigns. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court previously upheld the law's coordinated expenditure limits in Federal Election Commission versus Colorado Republican Federal Campaign Committee in 2001. In 2022, then-Senate candidate J.D. Vance, Republican of Ohio, then-Representative Steve Chabot, Republican of Ohio, the National Republican Senatorial Committee, and the National Republican Congressional Committee challenged the law in federal court, arguing that the 2001 decision should be overturned and that FECA inappropriately prevented national committees from coordinating messaging with party candidates. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case in December. Justice Brett Kavanaugh authored the majority opinion, writing that, quote, modern congressional limits, close quote, on coordinated spending violate parties' free speech rights under the First Amendment because they, quote, impair the party's traditional forms of communication, such as advertisements, preclude parties from amplifying the voice of their adherents, impose additional monetary costs and burdens on political parties, and inflict a stifling effect on the ability of the party to do what it exists to do, close quote. Justice Elena Kagan authored a dissenting opinion, arguing that coordinated expenditure limits were meant to supplement candidate contribution limits introduced by FECA to curb corruption. The majority's decision, quote, ushers back in the same opportunities for quid pro quo corruption that the contribution limits were meant to check, close quote. Republicans have broadly expressed support for the ruling as a win for First Amendment rights. Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina and Representative Richard Hudson of North Carolina wrote, quote, by striking down these unconstitutional caps on coordinated spending, the court has restored core political speech and ensured parties can compete on a level playing field, close quote. Some Democrats criticized the ruling as opposing paths for wealthy donors to exert undue influence on politics. In a joint statement, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, Representative Suzanne DelBene of Washington, and Democratic National Committee Chair Ken Martin said, quote, today's ruling is a win for billionaire donors and special interests who want more influence over the GOP agenda and an invitation for corruption, close quote. In this newsletter, we'll hear from the political left and the right about the court's ruling. Then senior editor Will Kaubach gives his take on the court's decision. First up, what the political left is saying. The highlights. The left is mixed, with some saying the ruling will enable unchecked corruption. Some suggest that the ruling won't change much about money in politics. Others argue the decision could have positive downstream effects. For the Brennan Center, Daniel L. Weiner and Joanne Zdenius said the Supreme Court continues to dismantle anti-corruption laws. Weiner and Zdenius wrote, on Tuesday, the Supreme Court struck down yet another federal campaign finance law, continuing its nearly two-decade drive to destroy anti-corruption guardrails. Since its infamous 2010 Citizens United decision, the conservative majority has reinforced the unprecedented fusion of private wealth and political power that now shapes our government. But the court is not the only branch of government at fault. For decades, Congress has ceded its authority to presidents and the judiciary and failed to pass long overdue reforms to repair our warped campaign finance system. Amid growing public outrage at corruption, this ruling must be a wake-up call for lawmakers. Congress must pass a robust anti-corruption agenda that would help end the era of massive money in politics that the court ushered in. Congress should take the NRSC ruling as a sign to start reasserting its constitutional role to better deliver for the American people. In Slate, Richard L. Hassan called the ruling not nearly as bad as expected. Hassan wrote, it's possible that the NRSC versus FEC decision makes our campaign finance system a bit less distorted in bringing candidates and parties closer together. All of these super PACs are unaccountable, spreading negative messages. Parties help preserve democracy in the court majority's view, and it was only fair to free the parties of limits on them. It's not clear that the court is wrong. Super PACs in many ways are worse than parties in campaign spending, and maybe funneling money through the parties could strengthen them. But I suspect that NRSC will hardly make a dent in either the weakness of political parties or the current deregulated campaign environment. The ultra-rich will still use super PACs and other means of spending big bucks on campaigns. In the 2016 campaign, there were no individuals spending at least $100 million in a campaign season. In 2024, there were 9 individuals or couples doing so, with all supporting Republican candidates. The plutocracy is real. In The Atlantic, David A. Graham suggests the decision might improve politics. Graham wrote, "The idea that political parties should be stronger may be counterintuitive to most Americans, who hold both the Democratic and Republican parties in low esteem. But many political scientists have argued that one reason American politics is such a mess is that the party organizations have been weakened for decades. Weak parties are less able to quash candidates whose positions come from the fringes of their coalitions or massively wealthy candidates. Lifting the ban on coordination won't eliminate super PACs, which raised $5 billion in the 2024 election, but it will make them less alluring to donors. Money can be used more efficiently if it's going directly to a party and candidate rather than to a super PAC that is legally barred from coordinating with the candidate. One reason Democrats reacted angrily to the ruling is that, in the immediate term, the GOP will likely benefit. In the long run, though, both parties will benefit." And now, here is what many on the political right are saying. The highlights. The right supports the decision, with some arguing it will improve election transparency. Others frame the ruling as a clear win for Republicans. Some say the outcome upholds free speech principles. In the Daily Wire, Trey Traynor argued the decision restored common sense to campaign finance. Traynor wrote, "The Supreme Court got this one right. For decades, these restrictions rested on a bizarre fiction that a political party could somehow corrupt the very candidate it nominates. Nobody who has ever worked in politics believes that. Parties exist to elect candidates. The court has now said what practitioners have known all along. The government cannot punish them for doing so. Coordination limits do not reduce the amount of money spent on politics. They just pushed spending away from political parties and toward outside groups. It is important to remember, parties disclose their donors. Their leadership is public. They file detailed reports with the FEC. If you care about transparency in elections, you should want more money flowing through parties, not less." In the Washington Examiner, Alexandra Kingston said the ruling helps Republicans. Kingston wrote, "Having spent more than a decade raising money for Republican Senate campaigns, I can tell you plainly what this ruling means in practice. The single most frustrating conversation in political fundraising has been explaining to donors why their money could not be used where it was needed most. The ruling fixes it. Campaigns and their party committees can now work together directly, pooling strategy, data, and resources without the legal firewall previously required. The practical effect is immediate. Every dollar now goes further, and the party best positioned to act on this advantage comes out ahead. for Republicans fighting to hold and expand a narrow majority across a map with genuine opportunity. The ruling clears away a hindrance on performance at exactly the right moment. Money will still matter. Candidates will still matter. Turnout will still matter. But the wall between party and candidate spending was costing Republicans real votes in close races, and it no longer will. The Washington Post editorial board wrote, "Political speech wins again at the Supreme Court." The board wrote, "One laudable project of the current Supreme Court has been incrementally restoring the First Amendment right of Americans to spend on political campaigns. Political parties are weaker than ever, and one reason is a 1974 campaign finance law that limits how much parties can spend in coordination with candidates. Congress limited coordinated expenditures to reduce what it saw as wasteful and excessive campaign spending," Justice Kavanaugh writes. "Such limits run headlong into the court's First Amendment precedent, which have repeatedly held that Congress may not dictate how much political speech is too much or how much spending on speech is too much," Justice Kavanaugh writes. "The root cause of such political distortions is the court's blunder in Buckley v. Valeo of 1976, which upheld donor contribution limits under a lower level of First Amendment scrutiny than campaign spending limits. A First Amendment distinction between political spending and contributions is dubious. Sooner or later, the court has to wrestle with its Buckley mistake." And now we'll conclude this newsletter with senior editor Will Kaubak's take on this Supreme Court decision. The highlights. On the merits, the dissenters make a stronger case that limits on coordinated spending are necessary to head off potential corruption. Practically, this decision will likely empower parties and reduce the influence of super PACs. Still, I don't think that outcome will change the kinds of candidates that are winning. In 2020, immediately after graduating from college, I started working on a House race in the district where my school was located, New York's 22nd Congressional District. My candidate, Anthony Bradizzi, was a moderate Democrat who flipped the seat in 2018 and was in a rematch against the former congresswoman he had beaten, Claudia Tenney. It ended up being a fairly consequential race, decided by the slimmest of margins. We went through months of audits, recounts, and legal challenges, and eventually, Tenney was certified as the winner by 109 votes out of more than 300,000 cast. A key Republican picked up the closely divided 117th Congress. As competitive and unpredictable as the race was, one aspect of it stands out in my memory more than anything else: money. Representative Brindisi had to carve out huge chunks of time every day for fundraising calls. As a field organizer, I knew that any time he could allocate to speaking with volunteers or participating in phone banking sessions with Precious and Limited. Every call to a prospective voter was a call that could have been made to a prospective donor. The importance of fundraising was even greater than I had imagined going in. The campaign finance rules that controlled how money was deployed made an even greater impression on me. Believe it or not, candidates, at least mine, play by the rules when it comes to campaign finance regulations. The National Democratic Party supported us indirectly, but we could do relatively little side by side, and we had to be extremely careful in how we communicated with anyone outside the campaign. We knew which advertisements were ours and which the party ran on our behalf, but we had no advance knowledge of their timing or content. We knew that the party was investing in getting out the vote, but it had no strategic coordination with our own get out the vote efforts. The dynamic was like an awkward dance in which the party knew the song and steps, but the campaign had to dance with blindfolds on and earplugs in. After NRSC versus FEC, the blindfolds are off and the earplugs are out. A lot of the commentary on this case has suggested that the decision will open the floodgates to more money in politics. In reality, it won't affect the amount of money in politics, just the way it's directed. And the legal question was narrow. As Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Elena Kagan explain in their majority and dissenting opinions, respectively, the question before the court centered on whether limits on coordinated campaign spending were necessary to guard against, quote, actual and apparent quid pro quo corruption, close quote, despite restricting political speech. Kavanaugh writes that restricting speech for this purpose can be permissible, but the government bears the burden of proving the constitutionality of its actions. He convincingly dismisses three of four potential justifications. First, he notes that the court has previously held that establishing coordinated spending limits for the purpose of reducing what Congress saw as wasteful and excessive campaign spending was a clear First Amendment violation. Second, he finds that the government does not have a compelling interest in preventing parties from exerting influence over candidates because the relationship between the two is so thoroughly intertwined. Third, he addresses the potential influence of donors, highlighting two recent court rulings that barred Congress from restricting spending because of the possibility that political parties, individuals, or outside groups may spend to impact elected officials' decision-making. With that said, one legitimate basis for capping coordinated expenditures remains, preventing quid pro quo arrangements via political parties. Imagine you're a wealthy donor who wants to boost a specific candidate in a key Senate race in return for political favors. You're limited in how much you can give directly to the candidate, but you can give much more to their party. Still, restrictions on party spending in coordination with campaigns makes this an inefficient vehicle for a quid pro quo arrangement. In theory, then, these restrictions prevent donors from using parties to work around the individual contribution limits that hinder money for favors schemes. Kavanaugh asserts that these limits don't actually prevent corruption, as the party is not obligated to use a donor's funds for their desired purpose. Donors can earmark their money for specific candidates, but the law already regulates and limits these funds. Separately, campaign finance disclosure rules offer transparency into how donations to parties are received and spent, creating a public record that acts as a strong anti-circumvention tool. And of course, caps on individual donations to campaigns and parties are still in place, so this decision doesn't allow for new spending that wasn't possible before. Thus, the majority holds coordinated spending limits aren't necessary to shield against corrupt donor arrangements, at least not enough to overpower the First Amendment concerns. This all sounds nice, but I'm not sold. As Justice Kagan lays out in her dissent, the practical effect of this ruling will be to turn parties into candidates' checking accounts, covering all manner of expenses that have nothing to do with political speech. A candidate, for example, might forward the bill from his pollster, or the rent or electricity bill for campaign headquarters, or the catering bill for a campaign, she writes. To me, this dynamic creates a clear pathway for apparent quid pro quo schemes, which even Justice Kavanaugh acknowledges is a constitutional basis for imposing restrictions of this kind. The majority suggests that rules on earmarking and campaign finance disclosures are sufficient to prevent corruption, but I think donors, parties, and candidates are too savvy for that. As Kagan notes, candidates can form joint fundraising committees that allow a single donor to give over $550,000 in one fell swoop. Before this decision, most of that money could only be spent on indirect support, such as bolstering get-out-the-vote operations or producing independent advertisements. Now that money can be spent without restrictions. I don't know whether this ruling will actually result in quid pro quo agreements that weren't possible before, but the potential for apparent corruption is immediate and obvious. Donors' direct impact on candidates was previously measured in thousands of dollars. Now it'll be hundreds of thousands. I agree with Kavanaugh that the bar should be high for imposing restrictions on speech through political spending. But in this case, Kagan is right that the bar has been met. So where does this ruling leave us? I'm biased, but I thought the best discussion of the practical effects of this case came in last week's Suspension of the Rules episode with legal analyst Sarah Isgar. Isgar said the decision will empower parties in positive ways, allowing them to exert greater influence over the kinds of candidates that are elevated while reducing the power of super PACs. Parties were the things that bridged election cycles, had policy platforms, and had carrots and sticks to hold candidates to those policies and those platforms, she said. But today, we have reality TV politics, where it's all personality-driven and candidate-driven. In that sense, rather than opening the floodgates to corruption, this decision could actually shift us away from insurgent, polarizing campaigns and toward candidates who better represent a party's voters writ large. It's another nice thought, but again, I'm not convinced. I think Isgar is spot on that super PACs will have less power in the post-NRSC world. Before last week, both parties and super PACs were restricted in how they could work with candidates, but the latter could take in and spend unlimited funds on candidates' behalf, making them a more strategic funnel for donors. Now, parties' ability to work directly with campaigns gives them a distinct edge. But is shifting that money toward parties any better, particularly when the pathways for wealthy individuals to exert disproportionate influence over candidates and elections remain? If parties could actually act as a moderating force, perhaps. But I think the degradation of party power over the past decade is much deeper than money, and rooted more in a loss of voter trust. Take one particularly top-of-mind example, Graham Plattner. His rapidly unraveling Senate campaign perfectly represents the consequences of powerless parties, poorly vetted candidates who create problems for the party at the local and national levels. But let's say the National Democratic Party had more sway in the race. What's the result? Janet Mills? Democratic voters chose Plattner over Mills in overwhelming fashion, even after some of his baggage was made public, a clear repudiation of the party's power center. Simply put, I don't think we're going back to the days when the GOP and Democrats were elevating distinguished candidates that voters placidly accepted. I think it's an even tougher sell to voters when the reason we might return there is more coordinated political spending and centralized party control. In a funny way, then, I disagree with this decision on the merits while doubting it will upend the political landscape. The vast pool of donor money is essentially unchanged. It's just likely to concentrate in a new area. Will parties benefit from this new dynamic? Yes. But I don't think that influence will do much to slow the insurgency of the Platners, the Paxtons, the Democratic Socialists, or the populist right. More likely, those kinds of candidates will keep winning primaries, and as a result, coordinated spending will eventually benefit, not hinder, their campaigns. That concludes our program for today. We hope you have enjoyed listening to Another Point of View, a program that gives a voice to both sides of the debate on current events and important contemporary issues. This program is a production of the Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the article authors and publishers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Audio Journal, its staff, or the volunteer readers. Archived editions of this or any previous program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or by using the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I have been reading original copyrighted material from the news service Tangle with their express permission. Tangle is an award-winning media organization that covers the major political stories in the United States. It is an independent, nonpartisan, and subscriber-supported, with a newsletter read by over 400,000 people in 55-plus countries across the world, and a podcast that reaches hundreds of thousands of listeners every month. Their audience is made up of conservatives, liberals, independents, and those who don't identify with any particular political tribe. Free podcasts can be heard on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. In addition to their free email newsletter service, news articles, and podcasts, Tangle also provides a variety of rich subscriber-only content, including special news articles, in-depth investigative reports, and interviews with current newsmakers. To learn more about Tangle and find out how you can subscribe, call the Audio Journal offices at 508-797-1117. This program is supported by the Worcester Memorial Foundation for the Blind, the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, and from generous contributions from listeners like you. Thank you. Our regular program schedule can be found on our website, audiojournal.org, or a printed version in large print or braille by calling the Audio Journal offices at 508-797-1117. Please remember, we need your feedback. How can we improve the program to better serve you, the listener? Call or email us with any suggestions or general feedback. We want to hear from you. Thank you for listening. I hope you'll turn in again next week. Please stay tuned to Audio Journal. More great programming is coming your way.
Would you like to hear news from Blackstone Valley and Webster that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune into Audio Journal every Thursday at 5 p.m.
What's your vision?
My vision's 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye and zero vision in the left eye.
20/200 at best on my left eye, and on my right eye, I cannot see.
No, I mean, what's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
My vision is employment opportunities for all, including people with disabilities.
My vision is for all of my students to dream big.
That he become fully independent.
For my patients to live their best lives.
What's your vision?
What's your vision?
What is your vision?
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, our vision is clear. We believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.